Hello, this is Jane Clark, the historian at Aintree Racecourse, and you're listening to the Midweek Drive Morning Edition with Alex Lefchuk.
So we're around to the Grand National before we know where we are, basically. All that food on the run, amazing. As far as the weather is actually concerned, 80 degrees centigrade is the high, 3 degrees centigrade is the low. The heavy rain will be easing up, and it will be brightening up for most of Lincolnshire. Much milder, but generally breezy.
This is the Midweek Drive Morning Edition on Siren 107.3 FM.
Yes, exactly. It's in this business, you're either a winner or your dinner. Sorry, still, never mind. It's like a haggis all over again. And what a perfect way of actually introducing the culinary delights that is just one of the magical scenes that are introduced into Song of the Eight Winds, Reconquista. And yes, Ian Peter sent me this whole thing a wee while ago, but until I got the hard copy of this, fantastic. Peter Kerr, welcome to the studio. How are you, sir?
Great, thanks, Alex. It's a lovely Sunday morning up here in East Lothian. What's it like round about Lincoln?
Wet and generally sort of dull. That's why we just that's the whole thing. But, you know, it's okay. You're bringing the brightness to the whole era, which is important.
And I gather we'll try and send down some of the sunshine for you, because it's nice this morning. Yeah, we've got daffodils out and snowdrops and everything.
It's like Majorcan sunshine in full routine. Now, you've been listening to the show, have you not, Peter?
I have, yes.
So you caught
very, very entertaining as usual this morning, Alex.
Well, there we are. Any particular highlights that you liked? I mean, the way I substituted a different word for the word that you actually put in terms of when we had the urination exercise.
Alex, there's so many highlights. It's impossible to pick one out. The whole thing's fantastic. Now, how about that for a
minute? It's just so wonderful, really. That's great from that. I think Ian Lennox quite liked the humorous text on that. But let's just gamble this one more time before we go into serious routine. Grace, would you like to give me a number between 1 and, say, 280?
128.
128. Any reasons for 128?
No.
Okay. See where this is actually. See, I would have asked Peter, but as he wrote the book, he might know sort of what slots to go for. Precisely. Exactly. It had been midnight when Pedrito finally accomplished his mission. However, all the king could do at that hour was send messages to the individual quarters of his chief barons, telling them to post scouts far enough from the camp to allow a warning to be relayed back in time for preparations to be made in the event of an enemy advance. Now, with the dawning of the new day, it emerged that no such precautions had been taken, due to the relative state of disarray that the travel-weary commanders and their troops were still in. This, at least, was the excuse given to King Jaime by Anguillon de Moncada. The king was not less pleased. "Only yesterday you told me that I would serve God better alive than dead. Yes, my lord, but the men have endured much and were suffering from total exhaustion, especially those involved in the skirmishes yesterday. So if the Moorish king had chosen to fall upon us with his army while we slept, how many of us would still be here to continue the crusade?" "I understand what you're saying, Majestat, but it's a pity more people in this army of brave Christians don't share my faith of impetuosity. If they did, an appropriately large guard would have ridden out in the early hours, even if their commanders were too tired to enforce my order." Anguillon was suitably contrite. "You've made your point, Signor." He gave a respectful nod of his head. "But I'm sure you would agree that an army of soldiers who take it upon themselves to do things on a whim would be an ineffectual army indeed." It's like Jose Mourinho, really. King James, of course. But King Jaime? King Jaime? King Jaime? What? I bow to your pronunciation in this particular one,
yeah,
Peter.
Yeah, it's Catalan. I think it's Jaume.
Jaume. Yeah, King Jaume.
And Castilian would be Jaime, and as you say, James in English.
Yeah. So what was happening there, you know, with this tale of Pedrito observing King James of Aragon and the sort of routine? I mean, he's an impetuous chap when he's actually lobbing heads over the walls, I found, basically.
Yeah, well, I mean, the story of the Christian reconquest of Mallorca from the Moors, who were obviously Muslims, in 1229, it's a fascinating story. And actually, the young king, who was 21, King James, we'll call him, actually wrote a chronicle, a full account of his life from birth, really, well, from when he could remember, right through that whole period. So I had the whole sort of skeleton of the story, the true story to work on. And what I tried to do was to weave a fictional element or a fictional thread through all that stuff, and that's where the hero of my book, Pedrito, comes in, who's the same age as the king, happens to be the helmsman of the king's galley when this huge armada of, I can't even remember now, it's something like was it 150 ships or something that set sail from the mainland of Spain to Mallorca. And what I've done is I've created a development of a friendship between the king, the young king, and his helmsman Pedrito. And it's a bit serious in some ways, because obviously, yeah, it was an invasion that involved a lot of bloodshed, but the sort of stuff that I write normally is not that sort of heavy duty anyway, and it's not all blood and guts. I couldn't avoid some of it in this story if I was going to stick to the truth, but I've tried to keep it entertaining, Alex, and that's...
I would put it as your best yet, Peter, and I speak as a huge fan, as you know, of Snowball Oranges. In fact, you know, it was fantastic in its own way, and the Gannet has landed, and a whole range of other things. I thought this was outstanding. I think you got the mix and the balance between the graphic descriptions of what was, you know, quite literally war being hell, and also the kind of symmetry, bizarrely, of the fact they're both fighting for different gods, one god, a whole range of things, maybe the futility of war mixed with the kind of romance as well. I think it worked well. Let's go to Stephanie. Any questions for yourself?
When I read a book, by the end of it, the characters seem very real to me. You know, I could imagine them walking down the street and going about their daily activities. Do you just pluck them from anywhere, or is there a certain strategy you use when you write in every book to create a character?
Well, it's, I think, Stephanie, it obviously depends. If it's a non-fiction book, then obviously you've got to keep the characters factual because they're real. In this particular book, Song of the Eight Winds, there were real characters, real historical characters like the young king and his nobles and so on.
You're listening to...
Sorry about that, Peter. It's just a rude person just bursting in with an ident. Yeah, worry about that.
But as far as the fictional characters are concerned, how do we pick those? It's a weird thing, Stephanie. Sometimes these characters pick themselves, and... it's like that little dog interlude that Alex read out. Why is there a dog in this story about war? Well, it's I like to keep a sort of feel-good factor in the books, no matter what goes on throughout the story.
And thankfully the dog didn't serve somebody's dinner, because that would have been too much. I wouldn't do it. I couldn't have taken that one at all. I said, oh.
Well,
no.
Yeah, and of course, yeah, there are a lot of horses killed in this book as well, Alex, but we'll see nothing about that.
No, precisely. I mean, as I say, the haggis scene, I thought, was nicely put together. And actually, in terms of the historical accuracy, that's another key point, because from the line in which you bring on board the Knights of the Templar and obviously the Scottish character who's brought into that, were you suggesting that actually the bagpipes were actually, you know, not a Scottish invention?
As far as we can gather, they were. I mean, people say that they were brought over by the Romans, but I guess that they were around a long time, even before the Romans. Mm. People have made funny music out of all sorts of instruments, seashells, and you've got all these cupids with panpipes and stuff that we can all remember today. And I think I did mention again to stick a little bit of humour into a serious story. I did mention that the bagpipes may not have originated in Scotland, but they do exist and have existed for a long, long time in Spain. That's a fact. Probably longer than in Scotland anyway. Although the bagpipes everywhere, they're all a little bit different. I think the Scottish ones are pretty wild and scary in the sound that they make, whereas the Spanish ones are soft. They hum like a bee, or is it sting like a bee? Whatever Muhammad Ali said.
Float like a butterfly, sting
that's
like
what
a bee.
He said, yeah, it's all sorts of bagpipes, of course, but you get the picture. The shepherds in Spain used to use the bagpipes to keep the sheep calm at night in the dark when they're grazing up in the mountains. The sheep could hear where the shepherd was, and that's why they wear the bells, of course.
We should have suggested that to Ian Lennox about his plumber. You know, if he had some bagpipes in there, everything would be sorted, as opposed to the singing plumber. Ed?
Yeah, to sort of pick up on what Stephanie just said, Peter, do you have, like, a maximum number of characters that you would ever put in a novel?
I'm not that well organised, Ed. I mean, even when I start off a fiction book, I really don't have a plot in mind. I don't have the whole thing sort of mapped out in advance. What I do try to do with characters, though, is if I find that maybe there are too many creeping in, then I make a conscious effort to stop that trend, because I think, as a reader of books myself, if you get too many characters, it then gets very difficult. It muddies up the progress of the thing if you've got to try and remember who did that and which was that Ed and which was the other Ed, and if you've got four Eds, well, I think you know what I mean.
Never a good idea.
Yeah, so in that respect, I don't consciously count the number of characters, if you like, in advance, but I'm aware that you can go over the top with the numbers, so I try and avoid it if I can.
I think there was a sense of realism that came across. I mean, the other thing initially I thought, well, it's a very masculine book, but then of course you introduce the two lead female characters,
yeah.
And the motivation of both of those really kind of demonstrate, I suppose, really the kind of desperate conditions that women were actually experiencing at the time, where certainly in certain instances they were either sort of seen as either courtesan or indeed cripple and sort of, you know, sent out beyond the whole routine, indeed the notions there. And again, I thought you coped with that very well in what could have been almost seen as gratuitous in certain ways. I think the violence you do introduce is very appropriate to the actual text, Peter.
But, yeah, that particular episode that you're talking about, when one of the women had a hand
cut off, leg cut off.
Foot cut off.
Not good, really.
These things did happen.
Yeah. And why did she have her hand and foot cut off? I can actually hear Grace thinking at this moment. Why did she have her hand and foot cut off, Peter?
Well, as far as I can remember, it was because she had a child. And again, I can't say
and
why.
And the child actually had a birthmark which was in the shape of the Christian cross.
Yeah, that's
so
right.
Obviously,
and of course, the whole thing, the whole theme of that war was about the Christians versus the Moors, the Muslims, and so therefore I didn't try and avoid that conflict of religions, but at the same time I tried to introduce truths about how these religions operated at that time, without, fingers crossed, being offensive, and I think that's really the point that you're making, Alex. Again, I'm not a great reader of historical fiction. I read a lot of history, but so my idea about this book, and I think I said that a bit earlier, was to tell the facts.
Peter, Hilary Mantel could learn a lot from your writing. Now, I mean, I like some of Hilary's work. She does a lot of work with the Tudors, etc. She's obviously an award winner. But I think Song of the Eight Winds, in terms of that particular period of medieval history and medieval Spain, absolutely sort of nailed on that. In fact, we're going to share this text. In fact, probably after the show, I'll provide Grace and or Stephanie with one of your previous texts. Just sort of, I think you can tell I'm enthused about this. You know, it's
good. Well, that's very kind of you, Alec. I appreciate that very much indeed.
And, of course, Peter is one of our patrons for Lincoln Inspired. Yay!
Exactly. I've got to mention this.
Well, Sarah Bullimore will be most upset. She'd be just hammering those. She'd be in the phone saying, oi, oi, you know, and Sue North, the whole range of things. But Peter, you'll be joining us in May, of course, as one of our literary patrons for what is going to be the best event Lincoln will be hosting in many ways this year. Well,
Lincoln
now, obviously,
Inspired, yeah. Exactly. I'm hoping to be down in Lincoln on Sunday the 12th of May to do the last event of the festival, which is going to be in the bowl full of tapas, which is owned by Joe Bycroft, along in the West Parade. And Sarah asked me, I must mention this, Alec, if I've got a minute,
yes,
that people shouldn't forget that the next fundraising pledge day is on Saturday the 2nd of March at 11 a.m. at the Drill Hall in Lincoln. And that will be the last chance for people to sign up for priority bookings. And they've got to bring along their fiver or their tenner to claim lots of exciting rewards. So there you are, Sarah, if you're listening. Big plug for you.
You see, that's what Peter does. Coming up very shortly, we've got the music patron from the line, of course, Elliot Morris. We'll find out a bit more about that. But the last two questions we need to throw to Peter at this stage are what, Grace?
Have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us today?
It's been fantastic as ever, Grace. Thank you.
Thank you. And will we be hearing from you again?
Let's hope so. I'm always here.
His Mallorcan recipes are pretty hot as well, really. That's the important thing. There we are, Peter Kerr in full force. Now, Elliot Morris, of course, award-winning Elliot Morris. So the first thing we actually put to Elliot in terms of questions was basically, how did he feel having just picked up a Celtic award as a half-Scottish soul, etc.? What was his feeling when he actually realised that, yes, he was an award winner?
It was amazing that night. I'd gone up to Glasgow knowing that I'd won a place at the festival, but I didn't actually understand that there was a first round, you know, there was a final and a final of the competition as well. And so when I played the show, I thought it went really well. And then I got a phone call up, and if I go back and be one of six winners to win an award and get to play next year as well.
So absolutely.
It was unbelievable.
Is it?
Yeah.
It's nice to know, and I know that you're half Scottish, but it's nice to know that our friends north of Hadrian's Wall can recognise quality and class when they see it. And indeed hear it.
Yeah.
You know, that's usually because, you know, Horncastle rules, that's what we say, and then continues to work through on that basis. So, when last we spoke, of course, it was our Myathon extravaganza that we were actually doing. That was a whole routine. And nice to see the end of the world was lined up for that.
We're still here.
As I said earlier to people who sort of said, oh, well, we're still here. Yes, but had we not done that Myathon, what would have happened then?
Exactly.
Elliot, right. You and me, and the rest, we saved the world, guys. You know, we saved the world. That's the important thing. But moving on, this Friday, that would be the 15th, the day after Valentine's Day, so the romantic theme is still going on in every sense of the word, etc. You are back at the Lincoln Drill Hall, and again, producing some marvellous, marvellous magic.
Yeah, that's right. It's a show I'm playing with Chris Woods, another great acoustic guitar player, and we're doing a workshop in the interval as well of the Occam's Razor show, but we're actually playing sets at the start and the end. I think you can buy a ticket either just to see us or to see the whole evening as well. If you go on the Lincoln Drill Hall website, it has all the details there.
I mean, it's interesting, Occam's Razor, because William of Occam, of course, who actually coined the term Occam's Razor, suggests that actually when in doubt, choose the simplest solution. It's the simplest direction that actually just scrapes to the point. Although I noticed that Occam's Razor, William of Occam, was OCCAMS. This is OCA HAMS. Unless, of course, we've changed. I don't know. It's very confusing.
I didn't know that either. That's quite interesting.
But if you want to drop it in, you know, while you're having a bit of backstage chat, I'm sure they'll be very impressed.
That's
going to
help me out, definitely. Thanks, man.
You know, so, or else if you get blank looks or you say, so were you actually influenced by the mathematician and logician William of Ockham when you sort of came up with your name? You know, or was it this?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That is actually quite interesting, the easiest solution. I should probably remember that because sometimes I really overthink things and things get a bit confusing, so I'll bear that in mind in the future.
As they often say, the devil's in the detail, Elliot, and you need to just step away from that and sort of say, right, let's just go for it, produce the magic. That would be enough for most, you know, developing mega world conquering superstars. We appreciate that it's only a matter of time before you'll be up for best musical score for the Academy Awards and the BAFTAs. We just need to get a movie together to actually sort of use your music, and that's going to happen.
Absolutely.
I'm speaking to directors.
I'd love to, man. I'd absolutely love to do soundtracks. I mean, I've dabbled in doing things in the past. I did this like a student project with a friend a couple of years ago for his university work, and it was just such an interesting, different way of writing as well. Because you know, you're given a brief, and for the first 3 weeks of having a brief and like a couple of screenshots, you're just completely blank, and you think, how can I ever do anything with this? And then it all just starts clicking once you sort of get over the wall and flow nicely. So I'd love to do things like that. I think
we should speak. We should talk. We'll talk off air and also other times we'll get together, because I'm sure we've got sort of various talent. In fact, we know we've got lots of talented filmmakers. So we'll start doing a few bits and pieces. You see, these are the bonuses you get on the Midweek Drive that you don't get with Alan Ritson. We love Alan. He's a great guy. But you know, he's into his folk. He loves his folk. He doesn't go beyond that. You know, that's the key thing. Sorry, Alan. Just obviously.
I won't tell him.
No, he's great. You know, doesn't quite know how to press the right buttons every so often. But no, I won't go on. So, as I was saying, it gets even better, because keeping the cinematic routine, you are doing your bit to actually help support, indeed, the revitalised Ritz Theatre and Cinema.
Absolutely.
I got
an email from them at the start of the year, and I'd heard about the project. I mean, I'd seen online that they were reopening it, and I thought, wow, cinema under a Wetherspoons, that's going to be great as it is. And then I read online that they were going to be keeping the tickets really cheap, and they were going to have the opportunity for live artists as well. And then I got an email after Christmas asking if I'd be one of the first people to play on the stage there first person in 20 years or something.
Yeah.
And it just sounded like a fantastic Lincolnshire project to back, something that I think is really needed, an independent cinema in Lincoln. I mean, considering the university and the media department and everything, it's just a fantastic, really, really well-needed thing, I think.
Well, of course, my own theory is that just as people remember when John, Paul, George and Ringo collectively came as the Beatles to Lincoln, etc., in years to come, people will remember seeing Elliot Morris on the opening
we'll see,
gig.
Maybe. Yes,
yeah, I think it's, you know, I think we're sort of heading into that routine. Nothing like a bit of hyperbole to kind of keep the whole magic going.
Absolutely.
It's the important thing. Now, returning to, obviously, this Friday, I say Friday, the 15th, at the Drill Hall, earlier in the show, Nicola Clancy, her first question after having heard yourself performing Stand Up Be Heard, where can I see it? Well, I would love to go and see it. I said, Nicola, I will have a word. I will pass this the message on. What do you think, Elliot? Do you think we can actually... I mean, is there a ticket still available for Friday? You know, so just...
I am not sure.
No.
I think, as I say, the best thing to do is to phone Lincoln Drill Hall. I'm sure they can squeeze people in.
We'll get that sorted through, because I think, you know, obviously she could be a roving reporter for us. You know, what the hey? We'll put her up there and sort of do a line from that. It's great. So we are. I've done my bit. You've got to keep the co-presenters happy, Elliot. You know, that's like the backy artists. You know, where are we going on that? Kind of slightly more sort of focused question, if you like. Not that the others haven't been focused, of course. I like to feel there's a certain coherence to this. When you're writing, I mean, you mentioned obviously sometimes get caught up in the detail. Is it a case of sometimes you can have a writing splurge and say, right, I'm going to produce, you know, several tracks at once, etc.? Or do you sometimes sort of say, well, no, I don't know, I'll do one a week. Or how disciplined are you in terms of getting the tunes out?
You can never. Say, okay, I'm going to sit down and write a song. It just doesn't work like that. So, I mean, January is always a quiet time for musicians. Luckily, I've had a few bits and bobs on this month, including the Celtic Connections and a few other shows. But I knew that I was going to be quieter in January because no one goes out to gigs, and I thought, well, I'll write some songs. I forgot that you really can't just say you'll write music, because your brain just hears you saying, I'm going to logically do something, and it goes, no, you're not. So it's normally on the way back from a show at 3 a.m, I've got to pull over at the side of the road and get my phone app, record a quick idea into it. And also very often I'll be up against the brick wall and I'll have 2/3 of a song finished and it'll just be that last bit that just doesn't come, and I keep going round and round and it's not there. And then one evening it will just click, and it could be 6 months down the line from when the song started. It could be 2 years, and equally it could be 5 minutes, and things just move really quickly. There's no way of knowing, which is the exciting thing about it, but it's also the really infuriating thing about it as well.
It's programming of genius. That's like a good thing.
Yeah.
People are listening to this, so want to actually find the music of Elliot Norris, just simply go online, you can download it, you can buy it. That's what I did. You know, that's what you do.
Right,
you actually, it's quite simple. You just go there, computer things, you can work it. It's still not quite as nice, I feel, as a physical album. You know, I'm an oldster.
No.
You know, I still think, you know, even a CD,
absolutely.
You think there's a physicality there. You know, even if you then sort of burn it onto a CD, it's, you know, just a thought there.
Yeah.
However, you know, modern times, it is the 21st century. We can't let you go without mentioning Lincoln Inspired. Of course, you are, and we are not worthy, our music patron for Lincoln Inspired, the event that takes place in May. I'll be anchoring the Doctor Who evening that's actually there. Do feel free to come along, Elliot. You know, always
great.
good for that. But from your own point of view, I mean, that is a great success. I mean, and hats off to Sarah Bullimore and the team, etc. I think we're doing pretty well, really, overall, in terms of not just sort of saying, oh, well, grants aren't available, actually getting off our butts and raising capital so we can have this festival.
That's the thing. For something like that, it takes people who really want to do something, you know, to make that kind of thing work. Someone's got to actually not only think of the idea but see it through, and it's great. I mean, I've got so many emails from them over the past few months that have just kept me for everything, and we're really creating something very special, I think. Mm.
Yep, no, well, I view it as very much going to be the East Coast answer to the Hay on Wire Literary Festival.
Yeah,
I think, you know,
that too.
So, anyway, we should work on that. Elliot, it's been fantastic just sharing some
thoughts
with you, shooting the breeze, etc. We've got two critical questions. You might remember what they are, but I'll throw them at you in any case. First of all, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us on the show today?
I have, yes, definitely.
So, can we look forward to hopefully connecting with you again in the very near future? If not on Friday, we send a few people along, possibly we can actually speak in. Maybe, yeah, I think, you know, Horncastle to Lincoln, it's not a huge distance.
It really isn't. Yeah, the next time I'm coming through for a gig, we've got to
I think we should meet up. We should do exactly. We should get that sort of through. And indeed, the other critical question is: I take it you will return, which is good. Yes, yes. But would you like Falling Short or The End of the World? Your choice.
Let's do The End of the World.
Yeah, well, somebody has to at some time. So, Brian Cox would like to take credit for it, I'm sure. But no, I'm sorry, Brian.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, you can popularise science, but precisely. Elliot Morris, we salute you. Take care now.
Thank you, mate. Cheers.
Elliot Morris, End of the World, and you can see Elliot, of course, at the Lincoln Drill Hall this Friday. And then, as we said in the interview, he'll also be performing to launch the official Ritz reopening later on in the year. Plus, of course, he is our music patron as far as Lincoln Inspired is actually concerned.
Hi, I'm Jim Broadbent. You're listening to Siren Radio 107.3 FM.
Thank you, Jim. But there are those of us amongst the whole connoisseur out there who would actually say that wonderful though that little ident is.
The finest in gourmet criticism and foodie delights. And the author of A History of Food in 100 Recipes. Quite clearly a question of quality personified. It's William Sitwell on the Midweek Drive Morning Edition.
Is very much light years ahead in every sense of the word, because he knows where his bread's buttered. That's the important thing. And you know, a genius in 4 minutes or thereabouts of televisual wonderment of food and drink, I think it's fair to say. Just a sort of magical sort of input in terms of what we're having there. William Sitwell, welcome back on the programme.
Good morning. Nice to see you.
Exactly. You can, of course, if you go to sirenonline.co.uk, there is a webcam. You can see the back of my head, and indeed, probably Grace and Stephanie as well. So, in case we
want
to. Well, there you are.
It's a little way.
So, should we do that?
I'll just make sure the camera is actually on in this sort of area. So, let's just talk a little bit on
there.
Talk amongst yourselves.
Yeah, there we are, you see. It's all there. I shall move back and get ourselves sorted out there. In case you're wondering, the other fine folk haven't sort of just been shot, and we haven't said that's enough, but. Ed has gone off to an academic sort of piece, quite rightly so, do some studying. So has Katie Grimerson. And Ian's doing his management stuff, actually. He's in the other studio base there, so that's why we love the glamour areas from there. So, Stephanie, you managed to catch this whole piece before we go into bread and, what did I say, sliced bread and the whole routine. What did you make of it?
Yes. Oh, well, I learnt a lot. I definitely got a few tips there. And I could not believe, with the French baguette, if you think it's gone a little bit stale, just sprinkle a bit of water and put it back in the oven, apparently. Should I try that out? Do you believe in that tip?
If that's what Michelle Rue Jr. says...
then that's what we go with,
then that's what you need to do.
Okay.
I've got to say, William, the chap who you were interviewing, who is obviously very passionate in favour of his home-baked bread and saying it's the world... I thought he was borderline paranoiac, really. I mean, he seemed to be... I would have been worried. You know, just the look in his eyes. I thought, I hope William's got a good security guard there, because I just felt he could go at any moment, really.
Well, I accused him on the programme of being behaving like a... communist, being a bit
fascist, exactly, yes.
And yeah. There was a bit of outrage on Twitter about that. But I don't know, I think, I suppose that campaigners have to take a strong stance and have to be pretty, passionate about it. If that means that they end up being insane, then maybe that's the way it goes. But I suppose that, you know, maybe if you start with a sort of insane passion, it trickles down, and then a few other people can take a slightly more sensible, you know, look at it. I mean, I think that, you know, white sliced bread is with us. It's not going to go away. A lot of people swear by it, live by it, haven't got time to bake their own bread. I mean, it's funny, you know, if you the debate on Twitter after that, the sort of outrage that I was suggesting that white sliced white bread wasn't, you know, the most evil thing since cabbage, was quite intense. But yeah. And everyone was sort of saying, we all have time to knead dough and bake bread, surely, but...
I'd be doing it in the studio now if it wasn't a health risk, actually, you know?
Yeah, exactly. If I wasn't holding a telephone in my right hand, trying to look up Siren FM in my left hand...
SirenOnline.co.uk.
That's what it is.
SirenOnline.co.uk. There, that's it. Let us know when you connect, and then we'll wave. I'll get the guys to wave at you. It is wonderful. You know, it's technology. Boys with toys. I have to say one thing. I wouldn't say I didn't agree with, but I do prefer the bacon sandwich actually on brown bread. You know, I do. Yeah.
SirenOnline.co.uk.
Yes.
You're crashing my machine. Anyway. Here you are. You're coming up slowly.
There we are. So just like a good, wonderful wine in many ways. So we work through that. Over to yourself, Grace.
Yeah.
Your thoughts on this whole brown bread, white bread?
Well, I only have like nice bread on like a Saturday afternoon. Well, you know, like posh bread.
Posh bread.
On like a Saturday afternoon.
How would you define posh bread?
You know, like probably go off in like a day. So I just eat it all in a day.
So kind
like
of your a bread
white
day.
Slice. Yeah, yeah, I like a bread day.
Yeah.
But yeah, your white sliced bread, you've got to have your white, like, why would you not? I love bread.
I tell you why you wouldn't, because the people who, the campaigners will tell you that there are a lot of enzymes and preservatives and additives in bread that shouldn't be there. And in fact, some of some manufactured white sliced bread, which of course uses the Chorleywood bread process, and the Chorleywood process uses very high speed mixing, uses very, very fast yeasts and so on, is, you know, you can produce a bread in literally, I mean, I think I said in the show that these scientists managed to shrink time, and they did really. And so I think there are people who worry that, is this a sort of danger lurking around the corner? Is this a future health scare, that the nation is eating things that really they shouldn't? And by the way, you can wave to me now.
Hey,
You see, this is the interactivity that they try on that Chris Evans show to actually get. They don't, you know, they don't get that different perspective, etc. Yes, well, we feel as it's another step forward. You see, William, this sort of virtual sense there. We're in your living room or wherever you happen to be. It's great stuff. It was a well put together piece, though, and I think for me, what struck me was not only the way in which we had the passion coming through for the system, but yeah, that notion of we are what we eat, and clearly, you know, the scandals about horse meat, etc. Any thoughts on that, William? I mean, clearly, we'd be remiss before we actually go to our countryside correspondents to not actually, you know, receive a foodie sort of person on traceability of food and so on.
I tell you what I think. I think it's the greatest thing that's happened in the food business for many, many years, because it's forcing people to think about the things that foodies have been banging on about for years, and that is local and seasonal, and finding out where it is that your food comes from, and also simply making your own food. And it's not, you know, and it's cheaper if you make your own burgers, and it's not very difficult. And I think it's good to support your local producers. The other thing is that people have unwittingly, of course, been eating very, very healthy meat. Which is the amusing upside to this whole thing. But I think that the problem is that too many major supermarkets have been squeezing their suppliers to try and supply them with cheap food, and the result is they have to go to suppliers who can then supply them with cheap produce. And if you have cheap produce, you get cheap welfare, you get a cheap system. So unfortunately, the reality is we need to pay a little bit more for our food, because if you compare, I mean, the figures on the amount of income that we used about 20 years ago, it shrunk by about 50% in the last 10 years, the amount of disposable income we actually spend on food. So we're spending far less of a proportion of our income on food at the moment. And this is one of the downsides of it.
I think out of my weekly budget, I do spend a lot on food. I think it's one of them things where you get what you pay for, definitely, in terms of quality.
Yeah. Anyway, next week on Monday,
I was going to say,
while I'm abroad, I'm slagging off street food.
Really?
Great, a good, fun debate.
Well, you know, I mean, you know, are we talking a hot dog, a dog with all the works, or are we talking just burgers? Are we talking about frightening things from that perspective? Any particular kind of street food, or is it just keep it street, keep it real, keeping it simple?
You will have to just tune in at 8:30 on Monday.
Exactly.
See it.
Or alternatively, just use that wonderful iPlayer device to actually sort of catch it up later. It's wonderful stuff.
And if it doesn't go out this Monday, it'll be the following Monday, but I've got film on both Mondays coming.
And, of course, you do realise, William, that we've taken that quantum leap forward because the next Bake Off competition we actually have, which will be coming around fairly rapidly, of course, we're talking that, you can actually, using the medium of the webcam, see it in person as we hold the things up to the cameras.
Well, there you go.
I thought you'd be excited, but I'll even change the angle for you now. I'll do that, and I'll sort of go from this camera here to that camera there, and then because I think you deserve it. You know, before we actually go up to Minty Steele, etc., you should get a second angle. So there's a different angle for you, much more glamorous angle. I'm sure you tell. Yeah,
beautiful. What a beautiful view.
There you go. Last two questions for William Sidwell, please, Stephanie.
Well, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic chat with us today?
Reasonable. It's been astonishing.
Lovely. Glad to hear it. We'll be able to speak to you again next week then.
No, because I'll be in Dubai.
Oh, wow. Oh. Very nice. Good for you. We'll hope to speak to you again soon.
William Sitwell will return. We will coordinate that. And we promise Charlotte Fortune we'll play her tune one more time. You can still, I know it's released today. It's the perfect line for Valentine's Day. It's Happy Valentine's Day, by the way, William. Did you do anything special to celebrate? Or is it a case of every life, really, every day with me is a Valentine's Day?
Nothing yet. No. I haven't celebrated yet, but of course, when I go home this evening, I'll be celebrating with my wife.
There we are, yeah. Only love.
And I'll be cooking up a dish from 1440 from the book Boke of Cokery, which is a dish for mussels written in medieval English.
Is it keeping that medieval theme going? That's the important thing. As Charlotte Fortune would say, only love can break your heart.